You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome into the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Have a very interesting show for you this Tuesday. We have a book here that takes place in the recent past, in the 60s, when the Beatles were all the rage. And we're going to talk about the Beatle Bandit today. It's a serial bank robber's deadly heist. I'm reading it right from the exact title. A cross-country manhunt and the insanity plea that shook the nation. This is a very interesting story. We're just going to jump into it right away. And I'll tell you, it's got twists and turns and a heck of a... It's even got a murder in here, too, which we'll talk about here. And it is quite the story, I'll tell you that. Nate Henley is our guest. He's a Toronto-based freelance journalist and author. He has written several nonfiction books, primarily in the true crime genre. His books have examined wrongful murder convictions. The Boy and the Bicycle is one of them. Scams and Hoaxes, The Big Con is one of those. And Organized Crime, which we may have to get him back to talk about the Mafia, A Guide to an American Subculture. I'm a huge Mafia book fan at that. Nate's most recent book, The Beatle Bandit, is the one we're talking about today. It's about Matthew Carey Smith, who is an intelligent but troubled veteran of the Royal Canadian Navy, who robbed Toronto area banks in the early 1960s to finance a one-man revolution. We're going to jump into it right away today. Let us welcome in to True Crime Tuesday, Nate Henley. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Hi, Nate. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me, Tim.
Thank you so much for being with us, Nate. But before we jump into the story, let's get a little bit of your background, more so than what I just read there, Nate. Tell me a little bit about yourself and first of all, how you got into basically journaling and chronicling other people's stories.
Okay, fair enough. I guess the first pertinent point is I'm actually was born in the United States. In Connecticut, my entire family are Americans. We're the only Canadian branch, the entire family.
Oh.
Skipping forward a few years, I went to university, Trent University in Peterborough. I always envisioned myself as a writer ever since I was a little kid and handwrite these long, you know, adventure type novels, mercenaries or terrorists or such. I had a wonderful teacher in grade 8 who would actually critique these books. And that was my first taste of literary criticism. And I realized I couldn't make too much money as a novelist. So I went to journalism school, studied journalism, and then just jumped in from there. So since the 90s, I've been working as a journalist and always harbored, though, this desire to write a book. And I always envisioned it would be a novel, but the opportunity arose to write a nonfiction book. A company named Altitude Publishing put out an announcement that they were looking for punchy popular history from Ontario or Toronto At the time, a bank robber named Edwin Alonzo Boyd had just died. He was a notorious bandit in the 1950s, held up a lot of Toronto banks. I pitched a book idea to the Altitude. They liked it. A contract ensued, and then a book resulted from that. And I just fell into true crime. They said, would you like to write more books? I said, sure. And they would send me lists. And a lot of these lists contained a lot of true crime topics. So I sort of became their go-to true crime guy. And along the way, started writing for other publishers as well, an American publisher, Greenwood, now BBC Clio, invited me to write which I obliged. And then I wrote some books for them about the mafia and etc. And so that's sort of how I got into it. I always enjoyed true crime, but I cannot honestly say I was a huge true crime buff before I started writing true crime books. I had read a few classics like, you know, In Cold Blood and Helter Skelter, but I was never, you know, but I wasn't a fanatic about it. I read most of history, social issues, that sort of thing.
So you were more of a history buff. If there was a subject that you wanted to explore, or one that the ultimate Nate Henley book, what book would you want to write? What would you want to delve into?
That's a good question. I have, as most writers do, I have visions for about 20 different projects going on, most of which I'd like to keep top secret. One project, though, that would involve both history and true crime is I would love to write an expanded book about Dutch Schultz. I had written a short book about Mr. Schultz, which is available from Dundurn Press in ebook format, and I'd love to really dig in and write a really long book, hundreds of pages. Because he was just this fascinating gangster. He was like extremely eccentric. This is the 1930s. He made a fortune from bootlegging, extortion, and illegal lotteries. And he's just a fascinating guy, and made a fortune, but was brought down by his own peers who conspired against him because they just really couldn't stand him and were afraid he was going to do some crazy things. Leave it at that. That's sort of a dream project that I've had in mind for a while, but might not get around to for quite a bit. But a really sort of expansive, something along the lines of there are some magnificent, huge books about Al Capone in the last few years. I'd love to do something like that. I've got shows.
So let me ask you this, Nate. Do you feel like, some of the best or better crime books out there tend to take place in the not so recent past? I mean, we're looking at, 60, 70 years ago. Do you feel like, I hate to say this because it sounds bad, do you feel like the flair, the panache that criminals had in those time periods from the 20s to, like, say, the 1960s or 70s, that these criminals had a little bit more flair than criminals today? Have we lost something in today's criminals that they didn't have back then?
Good question. I think part of it is just a reflection of the times. There is this sort of, and I don't mean to glorify these guys by any means, but there is something very stylish about these mobsters in their fedoras and their 3D suits and ties and jackets with Tommy guns that's sort of more striking and visually appealing than dudes running around in track suits with dirty hockey jersey or something on, which seems to be the case nowadays. And I think another huge thing was that a lot of the gangsters in that time, the 20s and 30s, were dealing with bootlegging, selling illegal alcohol. And from our modern perspective, our attitude is kind of like, well, we shouldn't have banned this in the first place. Like, this is, it was insane to sort of try to have prohibition and ban alcohol. It caused all sorts of than weren't foreseen. So there's more, I think, more, it's easier to sympathize with somebody who is selling illegal hooch than someone selling illegal crack, although they're both intoxicants. I think, crack still is illegal, or amphetamine or whatever. So looking back, there is sort of a bit of a sympathy that these guys are just got into the market when there's a big demand. And yeah, there was a bit of a panache, I guess you could say. There's always, these guys are just as brutal as anybody today. So I'm always careful not to overly glamorize these guys, but they definitely did have more of a concern about their image and appearance. That missed going back to Mr. Schultz for a moment. One thing he was roundly criticized for among his peers was that he was a slob, that he made some comment that he'd never pay more than $2 for a shirt, which even in 1930s currency was not a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. That would be about $20 by today's standards. And he'd had crumbs all over his jacket, and he'd always dressed like a, he looked like a bum. And apparently his peers were really appalled by this. Their attitude was making lots of money, got to dress the part, man. And they took this as a sign of his eccentricity, that he didn't dress well.
Huh. Which we'll bring this around here to the current book we're talking about here today, which is The Beetle Bandit, a serial bank robber's deadly heist, a cross-country manhunt, and the insanity plea that shook the nation. Matt Smith is the army. Well, is he's a veteran as well. He ends up getting into an altercation. We will talk about that later, a little bit later too. Give us a little bit of a background on this bank robber, Matt Smith, sure, because sure. He's gotten a little bit of an eccentric way in which he goes about his business.
Absolutely. Full name, Matthew Carey Smith. Mm-hmm. And to clarify, his father was named Matt Smith. So in the book, I referred to the father as Matt Smith and Matthew Carey Smith.
Let's start with his origin first, and then we'll go about his MO.
Okay. Matthew Carey Smith, born 1940 in out in the prairies, and his father is a journalist. Later becomes a businessman, and his mother, Helen Isabel Crichton, is a teacher, and he has an older sister, Leanne. Family moves to Ontario when he's quite young. His mother starts showing signs of mental instability quite early in the marriage. She is later diagnosed as having schizophrenia, and this is incredibly upsetting to little Matthew Carey Smith, because he's, obviously you're terrified that something bad is happening to your mother. And he's terrified that this will happen to him. He's a very smart kid, but does not very well in school. Seems very obsessed with crime and criminals. Lives in a bit of a dream world, a bit of a fantasizer. Drops out of the private high school that his father enrolls him in. And joins the Royal Canadian Navy. Seems to be doing okay for a while, but then drops out of that. And falls into this weird life, and that he's living in Toronto. At one point, he's working for his father, so he's got jobs and he's capable of work. But at the same time, he's like stealing cars. He takes police on a car chase at one point, and he is taken to court. And as part of his sentence, he's told to go get a psychiatric evaluation, and they conclude that he has schizophrenia, like his mother.
Okay.
But they don't think that he's a danger to society. So he's out and about. He also starts at this point, we're talking early 1960s, he starts robbing banks. And there's no real reason for this, other than as a child, he kind of admired bank robbers. Starts robbing banks. His very first bank robbery, he accidentally fires a gun and badly wounds accountant, who has to get a steel plate put in his head. And he alternates between being sort of a criminal and working straight jobs. Like at one point, he goes out west and works for INCO, which is International Nickel. Has a reputation as a good worker. He gets a job at one point in Toronto at Dunlop Rubber, operating a machine. And again, good steady worker. And he goes out west. He sort of accumulates some friends that he brings back to Toronto. And he finds a girlfriend, Eileen Charity Amiot. She is her Métis, which means an Indigenous father and a French Canadian father, Indigenous mother, mm-hmm. and then backwards. And at the time, you know, Canada is a much more racist society, openly racist, than it is today. So this raised some eyebrows that he's dating a person with Indigenous background, and they're living together in Toronto. So that's like people at the time didn't live before marriage. So Matt Smith, he's got a house, you know, he's living with all these people. And he continues to rob banks, and he's starting to develop this revolutionary consciousness that he wants to overthrow the government. And he rants and raves to his roommates, but he doesn't really have a clear idea of what he wants to overthrow and replace it with. He just seems to like violence for the sake of violence. And he has this macho man warrior attitude. He expresses admiration for both communists and Nazis, but not for their ideology, but just for the fact that they went out and committed acts of violence. So it's a bit of a nihilistic approach. And this leads up to the notorious July 24, 1964 bank robbery, Bathurst Manor Plaza. If you want, we can explain, or we can segue into anything else.
Well, let's rewind just a little bit. I'm interested to know, now he gets the diagnosis of schizophrenia. Obviously, he had a bit of an issue with his mother being schizophrenic.
Yes.
At this point, I'm curious as to whether there's and let's get a little psychological here. If there's a bit of a self-loathing complex at this point, because it sounds like he's struggling between trying to fit in with society versus trying to struggle with his own self. It almost sounds like as he's fighting with an identity of robbing banks and wanting to fight against society, it sounds like he's also trying to assimilate with society. It's almost like he's got this internal war going on with himself. Would you agree with that assessment?
I would. I would add a couple elements to that.
Okay.
He definitely had this internal struggle that part of him wanted to be a warrior and lead Canada into this revolution. He envisioned himself leading this revolution. At the same time, he uses some of his bank robbery money to buy a bungalow and moves his friends in, and you know, has TV and is like, hey, how you doing? And accumulates what we would consider sort of the trappings of a middle-class life, you know, car, mm-hmm. home, all this sort of thing. And the element that I would add, though, is he had this ferocious sense of competition with his father. Matt Smith goes from being a journalist to being quite a successful businessman. And he has this, his son has this intense rivalry with him, that the son feels like he constantly has to outdo his father. At one point, his father buys a tape recorder, you know, for dictating business, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. His son shows up with a tape recorder that's way more valuable. And he has no reason for owning this. He just wanted to one-up his dad.
Okay.
He will like drive, you know, he'll show up at his dad's place with a really fancy car just to show off. And he's really has this bizarre kind of thing that he's trying to show who's better than his dad. At one point, his father becomes, gets into property development. Mm-hmm. So Matthew Gary Smith buys a bungalow, an apartment with some of his bank robbery money and wants to get into property development, just like dad. So he has this weird kind of conflict going on with his father. And he seems to alternate between compassion for his mom and contempt. At one point, he lives with his father, who is sinking deeper into mental illness. His mother at this point is convinced that giant insects are roaming her apartment, and the only way to ward them off is to keep her television on and all her appliances on, including the oven. At full blast, and she'll stare at the TV for hours, convinced that she's engaged in some kind of telepathic communication. So, you know, he's living there with his mom, which is not the best you know, environment.
Yeah, not healthy.
So a very, very complicated guy, to put it mildly.
Is there any point where the father acquiesces and just says, you know what, I kind of see what's going on here, and I see that, or is he not in touch really with his feelings enough to say, you know, son, I understand what you're doing here. You know, maybe I need to make a better effort, and maybe we need to develop a better relationship here.
Sure. The father tries. The father tried very hard as a teenager. His Matthew Carey Smith's father put him into therapy, got him in touch with doctors, got him in touch with therapists, counselors. None of it helped. That the therapist said, well, your son just sits there and doesn't say anything during our sessions. His father paid for this very expensive private school for him to go to. His father constantly tried to give him advice. His father knew something was wrong. And he was not one of these oblivious fathers who says, oh, no, my son's fine. There's nothing wrong. One of Matt Smith's huge things that pains him is that his son could not get the treatment that the father felt he needed. That his son is diagnosed 1961 as having schizophrenia, but he's not ordered into treatment. He's told, well, go to outpatient therapy and we'll take it from there. Matthew Carey Smith shows up a couple of times, doesn't go, isn't punished. And the father is beside himself. His father wants his son to get some kind of treatment. Like, her father acknowledges that his boy has schizophrenia, but is desperate for some kind of intervention or help. And he's quite bitter towards the end of his, as things progress, the father becomes increasingly bitter that his son didn't get better help or treatment. And he believes that if he had gotten better treatment, maybe some of these crimes and this terrible shooting wouldn't have happened.
I find it interesting. You know, it's so simple, but it's so complex that you would think the answer to this on Matthew Smith's side, the father's side, would be to just reach out and say, I understand that all you want here is a relationship, that all you want here is to get closer to me, rather than stick you in therapy, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, that, you know, being schizophrenic, there is a certain amount of therapy that needs to be done. There's a certain amount of mental health treatment that needs to be done here. But also there is an emotional side of this, which also needs to be just having a relationship between the two.
Yeah, the two did have I'm trying to think of the right word, divisive relationship. Matt Smith did some extensive interviews in the 60s with a newspaper man named Scott Young, by the way, father of Neil Young.
Really?
A famous rock star, yes. Huh. His father was a famous journalist. And again, we're only getting Matt Smith's side of things, the father's side of things.
Sure.
If the father is accurate, his son was very moody and very spacey and would not engage in conversation. That the father would try to say, you know, hey, son, how's everything going at school? Yeah. And he just literally wouldn't talk or would just, talk about some completely unrelated thing at one point. And the son was, Matthew Carey Smith was a kid who would have these bursts of enthusiasm for things and then forget all about it. That he got very into ham radio, which was sort of the precursor to the internet,
yep.
Private radio network. His father arranged for him to take his exams and, to get involved with this. Matthew Carey Smith passes his exams with flying colors, and then that's it. Just loses all interest in this. At one point, Matthew Carey Smith says he wants a guitar. You know, his father buys him a guitar. I actually have a photograph of the boy playing the guitar, looking quite happy. And that was it. Like, he learned a couple chords and then no interest. So it sounds, and again, like I said, we're only getting the father's interpretation, but it sounds very much like his son is very difficult to reach. And I am not a psychiatrist. I don't pretend to give an armchair analysis.
I don't either.
But from what I understand, schizophrenia typically manifests when you're late teens, early 20s. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, somebody who is sort of pre-schizophrenic is, I don't even know if that's a word. Quite often they have signs of being a sort of moody, spacey, isolated. They're definitely something going on there. So by all accounts, he was a bit of, I think the word asocial might come to mind. Like, okay. He was just not a gregarious, outgoing kid. And he seemed extremely unfocused, that it was very difficult to get him, okay, what are you interested in? What do you want to do? What practical steps do you want to do to achieve this goal? Well, I don't know. Some of that might be teen moodiness, but I think he was a difficult kid to reach. And his father did try his best. But again, we're getting a bit of it from the father's bias. Although I have read letters from Harry Smith, Matthew Gary Smith, when he was in prison, he wrote extensive letters. And he doesn't express any kind of bitterness about his father. I mean, I might have missed some, but he doesn't dwell on, like, oh, I had a terrible childhood and I hate everybody. He was a bit jealous of his sister, but that was about the extent of his complaints about family life. And he, if he has any criticism, it's usually directed against his mother.
Interesting. Tell you what, Nate, let's take our break right here. When we come back, I want to figure out how you go from moody and on the edge of schizophrenia, being told that you're schizophrenic, to all of a sudden you want, and not really having much order, to all of a sudden you want to join the Royal Army and become somewhat orderly and a killing machine. I don't put two and two together here, so maybe you can help us out here.
Sure, of course.
Nate Henley is our guest. The book is The Beetle Bandit, A Serial Bank Robber's Deadly Heist, A Cross-Country Manhunt, and The Insanity Plea That Shook the Nation. We have a link to it in the description of our show today. Go ahead, click that link and pick up that book right now. When we come back, we'll find out exactly how Matt Smith becomes unorganized and apathetic to organized and all of a sudden wanting to rob banks and become a killer. That's coming up next in the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. Welcome back to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is Nate Henley. This is the book. The book is The Beetle Bandit, A Serial Bank Robber's Deadly Heist, A Cross-Country Manhunt, The Insanity Plea That Shook the Nation. We're talking about bank robber Matt Smith and a job that turns out very, very deadly. And we'll talk a little bit about that a little later here in the podcast. We're talking about Matt's upbringing. We find out that his father is a journalist, his mother is schizophrenic, and as Matt is getting older, he finds out himself that he's schizophrenic, but he doesn't really have a direction. He's kind of wandering a bit through life, but as he's getting older, he suddenly finds a focus, doesn't he, Nate? He's finding out that he wants to go a certain direction. That certain direction ends up being the Army.
Well, he doesn't give a huge amount of explanation for this. And again, in, you know, interviews I've read, he just sort of, I think it was one of his spontaneous enthusiasms, and like a lot of his spontaneous enthusiasms, joins the Royal Canadian Navy. He drops out before his, you know, his term is up. Mm-hmm. His behavior deteriorates. I've read his military records, and his superiors are saying, well, he's not interested in duty. He went AWOL. He looks like a mess. He won't, you know, complains about everything. They're kind of fed up with this guy, and Matthew Gary Smith wants to get out of the Navy, so he gets his father to write a letter, let him out. So there was a bit of that, and skipping ahead a bit, just to sort of explain something, because this became a huge issue at Matthew Gary Smith's trial,
Okay. The
issue of insanity, and this is sort of jumping ahead a bit.
Sure.
The defense was his only defense at trial was the insanity defense, and he had a number of psychiatrists testify that Matthew Gary Smith was schizophrenic. The Crown prosecutor, that's the Canadian equivalent district attorney, totally disagreed and said anyone who was rational enough to plan these bank robberies couldn't possibly be schizophrenic. So again, 1964, so this is the state of, you know, research on this is not quite as advanced. But in rebuttal, a number of the defense doctors, psychiatrists said, you got to understand that in a lot of cases, these conditions are not like a 24/7 condition. that you can have moments of great lucidity. And Matthew Carey Smith was able to hold down a job, but then he'd come home from the job and rant and rave to his roommates about revolution or overthrowing the government. He's capable of these very lucid, very sort of deliberative planning. At the same time, it's matched with these bizarro ideas of overthrowing society and installing some kind of weird replacement government. Keep in mind, his mother is very much the same. Helen Isabel Crichton alternates between moments of basically psychosis, and at one point she's institutionalized. But later in her life, she manages to pull it together to take like a train ride to visit Matthew Carey Smith's family. I read a few letters she wrote. Mm-hmm. So she does alternate. So it's important to stress that. It's not like a condition. There's different types of schizophrenia, and some of them are milder than others, and not all of them are like all schizophrenia all the time. But as just like to note, that became a huge issue at his trial, what is really going on with this guy's mind. And I have read some prison letters from Matthew Carey Smith, and it's very interesting because they follow a similar pattern that they often are very, they combine very normal, mundane things like talking about the commissary and a talent show last night and the prison lights go out at 10, followed by this bizarre segues into like, I have this tumor behind my ear, and if it had been removed as a child, I'd be a genius like Einstein. And it's sort of, you know, vacillating between these two sort of extremes. That seemed to be a constant. If there's a theme to his life, it was this constant vacillation between sort of relative normality, and I'm using it in air quotes, relative.
Okay.
And just bizarre sort of fantasy fueled, you know, near psychotic behavior.
So would you describe it, Nate, as lucid with moments of schizophrenic panic, or would you describe it as schizophrenic panic with moments of lucidity?
That's actually, it's a very good descriptor, but I would hesitate to answer for either way, because I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think that descriptor would kind of nailed it. One other little thing to keep in mind is that some of the work he did, like he worked as a machine operator at a Dunlop rubber plant, these are tasks that you can do, like, it's almost an automated type of task. Like, it's not something that requires a gigantic amount of, like, it's not rocket science.
Yeah, you can go mindless and just do the repetitive motion type deal.
And he would target shoot all the time. So he developed quite a good sort of muscle memory from his rifles, and target shooting and stuff like this. So he was capable of very practical minded things. At the same time, it was this weird sort of fantasy world. That's interesting food for thought, though, about the lucidity, psychotic balance. And I'm hesitant to wager a guess on that. But it's a good way to describe what's going on in this persona.
I think, and I can't speak for everyone in this, I'm going to take a stab in the dark here. And this is just my hypothesis and nobody else's. I think when you suffer with that type of condition, I think you can have, if you're in a moment of lucidity, or if you tend to be more lucid than having those times of schizophrenic panic, we'll put it that way. And I'm just framing it this way. If you tend to be more lucid than schizophrenic, like let's say you're working this factory job, okay, and you're working a deal where, you know, it's repetitive over and over and over and over again, it allows the mind to wander. And when the mind wanders, it's a trigger. Mm-hmm. It allows you to trigger and go off into a different direction. And there are certain triggers that allow the mind to wander to a point that may trigger that schizophrenia, because it allows for anxiety. Anxiety could become the trigger for the schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. I have a cousin who is homeless and also schizophrenic, and his eyes glaze over when you start to talk about, for example, guns or swords, anything having to do with a violent nature. And you lose his personality. That's the best way to put it. He's gone. David is no longer there. He's gone. And in his place is just somebody who's, and he doesn't get violent. Don't get me wrong. He doesn't get violent in that moment. It's just, he's gone. And then he's somewhere else. And then he's kind of rambling and he's talking about something else. And he's talking about a gun and what it does and, repeat action and this and that. And he's kind of reciting things, and you have to go, Davy, hey, come on back, buddy. And you're kind of talking to him, and then he kind of snaps back, and then he comes back to himself. But it takes a bit. You got to kind of bring him around full circle, and something brings him back eventually. It's not you, but it's something in that conversation that brings him back to that moment of lucidity. And it's not external stimuli. It's something within him that brings him back. So I think that when you're the worst case scenario for someone who's schizophrenic and untreated is to be in a job like that, where it is mindless, where it is a factory job or something like that, because you've got all day to think. And you can go off and think about something else that can trigger you and trigger you into, or kind of spiral out of control,
Well, and the other aspect is that he was receiving pretty good pay for these jobs, mm-hmm. up higher than Inco, and this enabled him to buy cars and guns.
Ah, yes.
In that if he was unemployed and had no means of income, he would not have been able to afford the guns to rob banks in the first place, because these were acquired some expensive weaponry. And some of this was derived just from his normal 9-to-5 job. Mm-hmm.
Interesting enough. So at this point, now it's an interesting jump from I want to be a good citizen to I want to rob a bank. Where does that come in? Why does bank robbery work for him? I understand having had the training in the Navy and having had the weapons training and having had somewhat of a training as a soldier, but how does he, if he was such a bad military man and didn't want to follow the rules, how does he absorb that and then decide, I want to rob banks? Was he any good at robbing banks?
Well, he managed to get away, four separate occasions and robbed, if I have my total right, about $80,000, which in 1964, you'd have to multiply that by about 8 times. So he managed to get away with a significant amount of money. From what I understand, the one thing he was good at in the military was using guns, mm-hmm. that he was a good shot. He practiced his firearms all the time. Would shoot with his buddies and stuff. And in his confession, I've read his confession to police, and there's also a lot of psychologists, psychiatrists were examining him. And they all came to the same conclusion, was that he viewed robbing banks as a broader purpose. And he felt bad if somebody got hurt, but he saw it as kind of a military mission. That you're a soldier, you go out, you shoot people, and sure, you might feel bad that you pulled the trigger and killed some enemies, but it's war. We've got a greater goal. And for Matthew Carey Smith, that greater goal was this weird one-man revolution he wanted to do. And this is the part that gets a bit tricky, because it takes place in the 60s, which, mm-hmm. is this radical revolutionary time. But he wasn't really in tune with that. He was doing his own thing. And it was this, like I said, it was extremely hard. You know, when I do interviews about this, I get constantly asked what his ideology was. What was his revolution? My answer is, I don't know. That it was just this sort of nihilistic me against everybody. And that he sort of had this idea that he would be like the spearhead, that he would spark other people to rob banks. And he wanted to amass a lot of money so he could get some followers and arm them. It was very vague. And I've gone through copious amounts of material that he wrote or that he has interviews, and he never spells out what he wants to replace things with, other than he doesn't want to be dictator. I should clarify that.
Okay.
He said that he would settle for being in charge of the police. That was his one thing.
Okay.
And he had some sexist notions about, that men should sort of be in charge and women should sort of mind their business kind of thing. Very sort of chauvinistic, sexist attitudes towards gender relations. But beyond that, like very vague as to, you know, what exactly he's coming at. He makes a couple statements. Like he says, the government isn't listening to young people. That's one of the only coherent things that he says. And the thing about that is that in 1964, probably everyone would agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like most teenagers would say, yeah, the government doesn't listen to us. And he thought that people were apathetic. He thought they were too complacent and lazy, which again, I think a lot of athletes would probably agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's extremely difficult to pin him down on sort of like there's no kind of platform he has. Very difficult to pin him down or any specific elements of this new revolutionary government that he wants to install.
Well, Nate, with those two statements that you put there, the apathetic statement and the fact that, you know, the government doesn't listen to young people. Do you feel that he really does believe that? Or are those just two statements to get what you could look at as soldiers to join him in his cause? I mean, what better than to have young people join him in his cause? And then he's got people that are able-bodied to help him overthrow a government.
Yeah. I mean, he does remark about apathy when he's in court. And he makes his last comment to the judge. He makes a comment about fighting apathy. So I think he genuinely disliked this.
Mm-hmm.
But I hesitate to put too much. I don't know how much thought he was actually putting into some of these statements. It was a lot of it is it, when you read his comments as a whole, it's very rambly. That's the other thing.
Okay.
And it sounds less like a manifesto and more like the guy in the bar who's had a few too many drinks, who's rambling on about his philosophy of anarchy or something. Not making a lot of sense. It's not very coherent. And so I think occasionally he just throws things out there that it's just, oh, it suddenly occurred to me the government doesn't listen to young people. I don't know how much thought he's put into that. His only core idea is that he doesn't like government, wants to overthrow. That's like literally the only core element there.
So hopefully he'll throw out these concepts and somebody will throw something else out and it'll stick and he'll make this manifesto eventually. And it'll all come out to be some big, beautiful plan that he'll put together and it'll all work.
Probably not.
Probably not. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
So you say he committed four robberies. Now, the robbery that we're talking about, the one that ends up violently,
yes.
is obviously the last robbery he committed, correct?
No. Actually, it's the third.
The third.
Yeah, I could run through the robberies,
please.
The last two, if you'd like.
Yeah, please do.
In case,
yep.
And for anyone listening, I have a siren going on outside my house. I live near a fire station.
Oh, you're fine.
Yeah. Okay. July 24th, 1964, he does his most famous robbery. And this is the Bathurst Manor Plaza, which is a shopping mall in North York, Ontario, near Toronto. And he's selected a bank, the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. And he's got this cockeyed idea that the bank is going to be loaded with cash because it's in a fairly predominantly Jewish neighborhood. And he doesn't dwell on this. Like, he doesn't throw out, he's not anti-Semitic, but this is just something he throws out there. Well, it'll have a lot of cash because, you know, there's Jewish people there. And for the robbery, he plans fairly carefully, steals a car and drives the robbery. And his disguise is he has a Halloween mask of Charles de Gaulle, French president, and a beetle wig. These were wigs that retailers were selling everywhere. Seen pictures of 1964, the Beatles are the big deal of the day.
Right.
They're playing a concert, two concerts in Toronto that fall. I mean, everyone's going nuts about the Beatles. So he buys this beetle wig and he's got a t-shirt on that says CKEY Good Guys. It's a reference to a radio station, CKEY. And that's his idea of a joke, that robbing a bank wearing a t-shirt saying Good Guy. So he leaves his car and he's got 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol and an FN, a Fabrique Nationale semi-automatic rifle, which is a military grade weapon. Canadian Armed Forces uses a version of it at the time. Goes into this bank and he's put the rifle in a guitar case, and the rifle barrel is too long for the case, so he's painted the barrel pink. So anyone who sees him on the street will think he's some sort of bizarre street performer or clown or something. They won't think he's got a rifle in there. Saunters to this bank. A number of people see him. I interviewed people who were in this bank and saw him approaching. Comes in, announces there's a robbery, and then he kicks open the door to the manager's office, takes his rifle out, and shoots the wall. And everyone's like this gets everyone's attention. Demands that they fill up all these sacks with money. And at the same time, he's making all these bizarro remarks that he says something about bank robbing is a tough way to make a living. And, you know, he's like, people aren't sure, is this guy being funny? Is he being serious? So he manages to get about $24,000, and he puts these haversacks on, leads everybody out of the bank. And at this point, he's walking to his getaway car, and that might be the end of the story. But there's one guy in the bank, Jack Blank. This is a middle-aged guy. He's a veteran of both the Canadian armies and Israeli armies.
Wow.
He's a military guy through and through. He is just furious that no one is trying to stop the Beatle, this robber. Why aren't you trying to stop this guy? Little historical thing. At the time, banks in Canada used to stock revolvers. And staff were actually expected to use them in case of a robbery.
Wow.
Little, you know, people think Canada is the peaceful kingdom. Well, no, not so much. So Jack Blank knows that the bank has revolvers. And he's like, give me a gun. So an accountant, Carmen Lamb, who I interviewed, goes back in the bank, gets a pistol. Jack Blank grabs it out of his hands, and he goes running after the Beetle Bandit. And he starts shooting at the Beetle Bandit. Beetle Bandit returns fire with his pistol, and they're blasting each other on a street. Like, you know, picture this suburban, boring, beautiful, quiet neighborhood, and they're blasting away at each other. And Jack Blank is a, you know, good shot, military guy. He doesn't realize the revolver only has four cartridges.
Oh.
The six-shot revolver only has four cartridges because the accountant, Carmen Lamb, had underloaded it. Because he's terrified that the pistol might fall on the floor and the hammer will hit a live round. Discharge. There'd actually, believe it or not, a guy in a Canadian bank had been killed a couple of years prior to this robbery for that exact reason. So Jack Blank's firing, and then four shots. One, two, three, four, then click. He's out of bullets. Beetle Bandit doesn't realize this. He thinks that this guy's got, you know, tons of ammo. Takes his rifle, his FN rifle, fires twice. The first shot hits Jack Blank in the hand and it deflects into his heart. Probably killed him. Second shot hits him in the head and definitely kills him. Just tears off, like, it's, you know, top of his head, takes out most of his brains.
Oh.
And the shot is so powerful that there's a window screen three floors above in an apartment building and it's splattered with blood.
Oh. Oh.
Jack Blank collapses. Everyone's going nuts. Beetle Bandit, though, can't get his car started. He's got a getaway car. He's got a contact switch in it, which allows you to start the car without a key.
Okay.
Yep. Contact switch won't work. So he's just killed a guy. Can't get his getaway car to start. So he starts plunking down the street, firing random shots. Okay. So meanwhile, this other helpful civilian named Jack Cherland had taken somebody else's vehicle and is tearing down the street. And his idea is that he's going to intercept the Beetle Bandit. Meanwhile, police cruiser shows up, turns a corner, PC Constable Donald Jackson. Beetle Bandit sprays the police car with bullets, like almost kills the cop.
Jeez. Yeah,
three times. Then he turns around and sees this other vehicle coming towards Jack Cherland. The guy in the vehicle, Jack Cherland, realizes, okay, there's this guy in front of me with a smoking rifle, just shot at a police car. I'm out of here. So he literally dives out of the car, but he doesn't take the keys with him. So the car just ambles on, hits a curb, and the Beetle Bandit realizes that this is the opportunity of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And in the book, I say if a Hollywood scriptwriter had included this in a screenplay, people would say, like, oh, give me a break. That's no way. That's unrealistic. That'll never happen. It happened, real life. So Beetle Bandit walks to this other car, throws his rifle in, throws his money in, gets behind the wheel, and slowly just drives away.
Oh,
and
my
gets
God.
Away for, he's at large for 5 months. And the police, meanwhile, are trying to, you know, figure out what happened. Jack Blank is hailed as a hero, given front page treatment. Police are trying to track down the Beetle Bandit. They have no idea what he looks like. They have shell casings in the crime scenes. They figure he's got an FN rifle. So their big plan is to search all the gun shops for sales of this weapon. And at Canada at the time, you were supposed to register all firearm sales in Canada. But for mysterious reason, they defined a firearm to mean a pistol or revolver or an automatic weapon.
Okay.
So bolt action rifle, shotgun, semi-automatic rifle doesn't have to be registered.
Oh.
So it turns out they can't track down the murder weapon. There's this huge effort, and it's just, I described this, like pre-computer days. So these cops are wading through thousands of receipts from gun stores, can't find the weapon. Beetle Bandit is eventually caught on a fluke. He robs a bank in November 1964 in a small town called Sutton, Ontario. Skip forward 2 months later, January 1965, he's driving up Yonge Street, which is the main drag in the town. He's got his girlfriend's younger brother in the car. They get pulled over on a very random check of license plates. This motorcycle cop happened to have a list of wanted cars, and long story, but his car got on this list. Pulled over, taken to the station, and at the station, a pistol falls out of Matthew Carey Smith's belt. Cops realize, okay, this is serious. They grab the gun, and Carey just starts rambling on. Oh, yeah, you know, revolution. He admits that he's the Beetle Bandit, and the cops search his house and find like 20 guns. They find the murder weapon. That's the thing.
God.
They match the murder weapon. And Smith just very casually does this confession about revolution. And yeah, I robbed these banks, and he feels bad that he shot Jack Blank. And so now he's captured. So that's the long-winded tale of what happened.
He just vomited it all up. He just came right forward and...
Oh, yeah. No, I've read the confession, and he's just going on about, you know, revolution and robbery, and, oh, yeah, I shot Jack Blank, and, you know, he feels some remorse for it, but he, again, describes it as kind of an act of war. So now this sets the scene for his trial, and I don't know if you want me to get into that.
Yeah, or... please. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so Matthew Carey Smith is put on trial, and as I mentioned earlier, his defense does not even attempt to say he didn't commit these crimes.
Okay.
His defense admits he committed all these crimes, but his defense said he's, legally insane. And Canada uses something called the Macnaughton Rule, which is a British thing.
Okay.
If a prisoner is so befuddled that they don't understand that they committed an evil act or a crime, they're considered legally insane. And they can't be hanged. Canada still had capital punishment. Legal insanity is different than medical insanity. So all these doctors testify that Matthew Carey Smith is schizophrenic. He has these delusions of grandeur. He has rambling speech. He has these fantasies. The Crown, which is the Canadian equivalent of the district attorney, says, no, that's nonsense. They have this amazing description. They said he's an ordinary bank robber or something like that. And it comes down to the jury rejects the insanity defense, finds him guilty, and the judge sentences him to hang. And Matthew Carey Smith gets up and says says something like, well, I still believe in the revolution and overthrowing the government, and that's all I want to say. Sits down. He goes to court. This becomes a huge cause celeb because at the time, no one had been hanged in Canada since 1962.
Okay.
Capital punishment is this red hot issue in Canada. Huge opposition to it. Also, a lot of people in favor of it. So eventually, the government of the day, the Liberal government, commutes Matthew Carey Smith's sentence along with two other guys. And this is the turning point in Canada that it becomes obvious that no one else is ever going to hang. They don't officially abolish capital punishment to 1976, but this 1965, it's pretty much no one else is going to be hanged in Canada. Matthew Carey Smith goes to jail, writes his upbeat letters to his wife. He has a son by this point, or his mom. He writes letters to his common law wife, I should say, Eileen Charity Amott. They have a son at this point. Then in the summer of 1966, he commits suicide. He slashes his wrists in jail and dies and doesn't leave behind any notes or messages as to why.
I'm kind of, and I know this is one of those how big is a baby elephant questions here, Nate, but so he slashes his wrists in prison. What does he get a hold of in order to do that? I mean, you would think that a guy who obviously is mentally ill, I mean, he's not going to be, I mean, he's on death row. You would think he would be in some sort of, I don't want to say suicide watch, but he would be treated a certain way being mentally ill, you would think, right?
Well, yeah, because he committed suicide in jail, they had to do an inquest.
Okay. It
turns out that he was not put in the psychiatric wing at the prison, even though all the prison doctors said that he was either schizophrenic or close to it. And the logic was that he would have more opportunities to socialize and do work-related activities in general population. So he's in general pop. Prisoners in the psychiatric wing are not given razor blades to shave themselves.
Okay.
Prisoners in general pop are. Aww. So he uses a safety razor, just a razor blade, cuts his wrist. And this becomes, again, a bit of a scandal because they're like, why on earth didn't you put him in the psychiatric part? And they have, like I said, they have this ridiculous, basically it comes down to they thought he'd had a better time of it in general pop. But it became like front page news, like this idiotic decision not to put him on suicide watch or something. And there's never been any reason as to why he did this. I interviewed the Beetle Bandit's son, who's named Carey Jr. He's a lovely guy.
Okay.
He was just a little baby when his father died. His theory was that his father is in jail, has a lot of time to think about things, and was overwhelmed with remorse for killing Jack Blank. And there's some corroboration that apparently he did express to journalists some regrets about his path and about violence and revolution. So his son's theory was that he was overwhelmed with guilt and killed himself. But I haven't found any kind of, I said in my book, I said that sounds as good as reason as any, but I can't really think of any other alternative, and I'm not going to pretend to get into his mind and claim that I know why he did this. It's still a mystery.
Yeah, I mean, true, but I'm just going to play devil's advocate again here, Nate. I understand the guilt. I mean, especially people are going to think I'm nuts for saying this. And I don't mean to use that terminology. I apologize for using that terminology. But if there's such a thing as being a good bank robber and feeling remorse for killing Mr. Blank, you would think also that he could seek some sort of counseling in jail, right? There's got to be some sort, even if it's some sort of religious counseling in jail or talking to somebody in jail, to get it off of his chest, to say, hey, you know, I do feel remorse, and work his way through it that way.
You would think he did see doctors in jail, but mostly to complain about physical ailments.
Okay.
That he claimed he had some issues with his ear, and that and then he had this idea that there was like some like lesions in his brain, and that might explain his behavior. They did various tests, by the way, both while he was alive and then subsequent after he died. They couldn't find anything. Couldn't find anything organically wrong with his brain.
Okay.
And there's no organic test for schizophrenia, just so people are aware. You're entirely right, though. I guess, and this is verging on armchair examination, but sure, I suspect that this might have been tied in with this warrior attitude, that I'm a warrior, I'm a soldier, I did this mission, the revolution failed, you know, therefore, somewhat like Japanese soldiers in the World War II would commit suicide as sort of remorse for defeat. This might be putting way too much thought into it, but I think it is tied in with that sort of warrior man attitude.
But I see where you're going with it, Nate, but also a lot of soldiers came back from a lot of wars, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, with PTSD, because things did happen over there where they did kill innocents. And there were a lot braver men than Matt Smith that came back and dealt with those issues and are still dealing with those issues to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I'm throwing that one out there that it's a mystery. People, like with a lot of stuff with Matthew Curry Smith's life, didn't really make a lot of sense because his sentence had just been commuted. You know, he was a young guy, he was 24, so theoretically he could have served, I don't know, 30 years and then managed to get parole and then see his family.
Sure.
I know it sounds like throwing my hands in the air, but with a lot of things with this character and with this book, I just say it's really inexplicable. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. And like a lot of, I think that his whole life didn't make a lot of sense in many ways.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's true. And it's hard to, and we shouldn't judge people who are mentally ill that on their actions and try to second guess where they're going with certain things. But, you know, you never know what happens at that moment when they decide to take their life too. I mean, you just have no idea. And to that manner, you know, God rest his soul. I mean, there's, you know, there, hopefully, you know, I don't know where I'm trying to go with this, but I guess there's, you know, you hope that maybe at that moment there was something in there that he could forgive himself at that point, because it, you know, in the end, I think, you know, I'm sure at that point, I'm sure the family is done everything they can to try to forgive him. And you know, I don't know what solace you are thinking you can try to find at that point, you know, as you know, you're doing your time, you know, there's that. You know, if you do your time, you're paying it off as far as the state is concerned, or the you know, the province or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So there's that way of paying it off. you know, the other way is to actually pay off your in physical time and then get out and then try to do whatever you can for the family. You know, there's different ways of paying that off rather than the way he took. But, you know, again, when you're mentally ill, there's no there's no way to come to those conclusions in a justifiable way.
I think one way that makes it a little more clear is most, you know, most average people wouldn't just decide to buy guns and rob banks to form anti-revolutions. So that's kind of his mindset. So that makes the suicide more understandable. It's still a bit of a, you know, it's still obviously a mystery, but, you know, the guy's whole life was kind of these bizarre things that don't make a lot of sense. I had mentioned that when he was younger, he randomly stole a car, even though he had his own car, and tried to run into a police cruiser and then led the cops on this random chase through North Toronto. And he could, and when he was taken to court, he could give no reason at all for doing this. And the judge was just baffled. Why? You own a car, but you just decided to ditch it and steal another car and then deliberately get in a car chase? Like, so yeah, his whole life was a bit confusing.
I'm curious as to whether you know or you interviewed his widow and what she had to say about all this.
His widow, Eileen Charity Amiot, had died before I could speak to her.
Oh, no.
However, I was able to speak to, she had a daughter from, she had been married previous to meeting Matthew Carey Smith. So she had a daughter named Estelle, who actually lived with Matthew Carey Smith at the house, full of guns, little three-year-old kid.
Really?
So I was able to talk to her, and that was, she was wonderful. She, you know, explained what happened after Matthew Carey Smith died. The family was in dire poverty. They were helped out by Matthew Carey Smith's father. And she said her mother never really talked about the details of the crimes, but made it clear that she still loved Matthew Carey Smith and said something to the extent of, you never know who you're going to fall in love with. She didn't excuse his actions, but she seemed to be sort of, at least this is interpreting through her daughter, seemed to be of the mindset, well, you know, this is the guy I love. He did these things and I still love him. And beyond that, didn't really give a huge amount of explanation to her back, you know, devotion to this guy or anything like that.
Interesting. The book is The Beetle Bandit, A Serial Bank Robber's Deadly Heist, A Cross-Country Manhunt, and The Insanity Plea That Shook the Nation. It is available right now. We have a link to the book in the description of this program. We encourage you to go get the book. Again, we've only scratched the surface of this book. There's much, much more in the book for you to go ahead and explore, and it is a fascinating story. Nate Henley, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on True Crime Tuesday.
Thank you very much, Tim. And I really enjoyed it. And I like the opportunity to talk about the book, obviously. And I also like getting these good questions, you know, some, you know, good questioning there. And I hope you can make me sound coherent.
Oh, well, absolutely. You're very coherent. I hope I didn't fumble and bumble with you as well. So there you go. All right. It's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free, and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.